Hey everyone, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush.
That's me.
Yeah. All right, we're back here with that thrilling introduction. Those thrilling words from our sponsor. Show a little energy, show a little excitement. Anyway, whatever.
What 1934 movie are you referencing?
Nothing. Nothing.
That's a classic line from All That Jazz from Zane. Yeah,
that's right.
The kids will love that.
Yeah. Okay, whatever. We're here talking about Aaron Blanchfield versus Menon Fiorot going down at Boardwalk Hall in Atlantic City this week. The UFC had to get out from under the apex, and the card is much better for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
We know how it goes.
I'm not saying Blanchfield Fiorot is going to be like a huge upgrade on last week's main event. It could easily be the exact same kind of fight that we got out of Nami Yunus Hibash, frankly.
And that wasn't a bad fight. It wasn't a bad fight. Mediocre and, you know, not very dramatic.
It was just a low simmer of a fight, which is always frustrating because it's always one of those things where you're like, oh, you guys could do more. I know you can do more. Mm-hmm. It's just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that can easily be true of Blanchfield and Fiorot. That is, in fact, the fights both of them have had most recently have been performances where both of them was just like, you are grinding out a win here that does not impress.
Yeah, but at least this has the requisite relevance of a main event. Yes. Whoever wins this fight is almost certainly fighting for a title next.
Yep. And it's got a great co-main that's going to be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's got a few fights down further down the card that I'm looking forward to. It doesn't all have to be good to be good. It just has to be, like, give me a main and co-main at least. You know?
Chris Weidman's Viking Funeral.
Oh, my God. Did you see
I've been told that he's actually going to be allowed to bring his wife and his three favorite slaves into the cage with him, and Bruno Silva's going to knock all of them out too, so that he can they can go into the afterlife as a group.
They're gonna burn the whole thing in the middle of the arena and have to bring out a new one.
What Chris Weidman has achieved, you get to take a little extra with you. You know,
that's right. Shame that it had to be that John Volante had to go, but you know.
Yeah, John Volante, his trusted footman, will absolutely be in there. He's going in the mound.
Yeah, no question.
What was I supposed to have seen regarding Chris Weidman? Something depressing, I gathered by your tone.
Yeah, his comments this week about this fight.
Talking about how he's going to be champion again still?
It did include a... I feel like, you know, everybody says I'm looking in the so is so good in the gym that I could be right back on top again.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also he's talking about, you know, this is Dana White has said he wants him to retire. I'm sure everybody else except for the people in his camp have told him they want him to retire. This had the look and feel of a retirement fight. It's back in Atlantic City in a bout that he could actually win, potentially. And Weidman has said, "I'll judge whether or not it's time for me to walk away based on not on my results in the fight, but on how I feel during training camp." And if I don't feel like I can, like, get in there and do the work and enjoy training and all that, that's when I'll know it's time. It's like, man,
you can just train for fun, right?
Yeah, GSP still trains all the time.
You don't have to fight.
And, like,
because he doesn't seem to enjoy the fights.
You have been training every day for 20 years. Uh-huh. That is your routine. You are probably never going to feel like you just don't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
especially not the way Chris Weidman is wired. Seems like a dude who
he's a draft just, horse.
Yeah, he lives to be in the gym. That cannot be. You have set the bar for yourself that you know you will always pass. That is not the bar to set here.
Mm-hmm.
The bar needs like the UFC shouldn't be giving him more fights, and they really, I don't care if he wins this fight, they should not give him another fight after this.
They will.
They will.
They might get another one even if he loses.
Yeah.
He's Chris Weidman.
I know.
That's how it goes, man. Every last drop.
Yep. So there, I have a little bit of doom over that. It's true. But then there's Bill Algeo, Kyle Nelson, and Nate Landwehr, Jamal Emmers, and even Vernon Jandiroba, Lupita Godinez. Mm-hmm. Those are all really cool, fun fights.
Yeah. So there's quite a few.
Yeah. I'm even looking forward to Malkoon Petroski.
Mm-hmm. Julio Arce, Herbert Burns. Not bad.
Yeah. Julio Arce, Herbert Burns. You know, we always love to watch Julio Arce.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a solid card.
It's a fight night card.
Yep.
I'll take it.
What a fight night card should be. All right, let's dive in, though. Blanchfield Fiorro.
I regret to inform you that I have decided to start pronouncing it the way it is pronounced, which is apparently Fior.
Fior. Oh, that's right. Blanchfield Fiorro.
Bullshit. I feel like we all went along very politely when the French started leaving off like the last letter or two.
Mm-hmm.
When, or like, you know, when they leave off the last
word. This is half the word.
Yeah. They leave off the last consonant. And we're like, that's all right. Okay, fine. You know. But it's not Hercule Poirot. It's Poirot, goddamn it.
It's probably really like Manon Fiorro.
Maybe she just says it so breathily that John Anik hasn't bothered to, he can't actually tell there's a sound there.
Yeah, it's Manon Fiorro.
They do have some words like that.
Fiorro.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, okay, so it's Manon Fiorro. That's fine. Yeah.
It's like the French word for cider.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's cidre. Yeah, that little R E at the end. You do hear it. Cidre.
Yep.
But it's barely there.
So I would assume it's the same way with Fiorro. You know, it's like,
well, I think it's Fior. I don't know.
It's probably Fior. I'm trying not to hate French with the same passion I hate Portuguese.
Why?
That's all.
French is just stupider Portuguese. It's always been, that's what, when people make fun of Portuguese, they say, yeah, speak Spanish with a French accent.
Yeah.
The French started it. It's their fault. Yeah. So good main event. I mean, title relevance. Like I said, this is pretty clearly a number one contenders matchup.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a pretty interesting style clash. And speaking of clashes, these two ladies are going to smash their noggins together on perhaps a dozen occasions.
Yeah.
That was something that really jumped out at me watching, well, all of Blanchfield's fights.
Yeah.
And a few of yours, to be honest.
Blanchfield really does have that bouncy, bouncy, bouncy. Oh, I'm bouncing into the pocket now, leading with my entire body.
Yeah.
And just like, I'm going to throw myself at you in a way that makes you have a car crash with me.
Yeah. And that combined with the fact that there just do tend to be more head clashes in Southpaw Orthodox matchups.
Yep.
And so I went and watched Aaron Blanchfield's fight with JJ Aldrich. And there are like 10 head clashes in like a round and a half.
Yep.
It happens constantly. So that's going to happen. Maybe Manon will have another just insane amount of blood pouring out one side of her head, like she did against Nama Yunus. Otherwise, I don't think it's not a very easy fight to call.
No, I mean, like I said, both these women are coming off this with a lot to prove, which is that against well-schooled, decent athletes, their games both can be really anemic.
Yeah. Yeah. Fior, I mean, on the one hand, I think Fior had the better of the two in her last performance.
Yes.
She had the benefit of fighting a former strawweight who smashed her hand 2 minutes into the fight.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a caveat there. Blanchfield, on the other hand, fought maybe the only other woman in the division, no longer in the UFC, but maybe the only other woman in the division who's like Fiora's size, mm-hmm. and possibly a more explosive athlete. So yeah, little caveat that may explain some of the difference in impressiveness of their performances. But for Fiora, we saw that when Rose Namajunas really started to pressure her, she didn't like it.
Yeah.
She didn't deal with it all that well. She got really sucked into the gallopy footwork, couldn't quite get settled, ended up giving away a ton of initiative just because her opponent was simply somewhat able to cut off the cage and determined to keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I thought it was probably her best boxing performance so far.
Yeah.
Her tightest combination punching. She is ironing out the Holly Holmness a little bit, it seems.
Yeah, it would be good because, I mean, she's like Holm, a big, powerful athlete.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you just want to be like, just sit down on this shit. Just, yeah. You know, just plant your feet.
I thought this was the best version of that. Her combinations looked much tighter. She looked a lot more confident with her left hand. She is a southpaw who is, I assume, a converted southpaw. Because she's really right-hand heavy in most of her performances. Jabs, right hooks, lead leg side kicks. Those are her moves. This, I thought, was her best left-hand performance. The least amount of her chin flying up every time she threw it. And her overcommitting and falling in every time she threw it. She just looked pretty tight and polished in comparison to some of her previous performances. But when the pressure ticked up, her tendency to move way too much and give ground, she did sort of pay for that in the last round of that fight. Blanchfield, on the other hand, shot for, I think the number is 14 takedowns on Tyler Santos. Didn't get one.
Yep.
Blanchfield, one takedown.
Blanchfield is, suffering a bit from Muhammad Mokaev problems.
Well, worse, because Mokaev does have some layers and depth to his wrestling.
Yeah, no, I mean,
Mokaev can afford to fail on the shot.
Yeah.
And then he might hit like a peek out, or he might switch to a single and run the pipe on you, or he might spin around and take your back, whatever. Blanchfield is simply just not a very good takedown artist.
Yeah. And she's got a game where she's geared it really heavily towards the idea that she can just bully people.
Yeah. She muscles every single thing she does.
And at the top of the division, it's not going to happen. These people are just going to be stronger than you. I mean,
yeah.
Most of the featherweights, or most of the top level flyweights out there, I feel pretty confident saying Blanchfield is probably one of the weakest, just for pure like strength.
I think she's pretty strong, and she's certainly extremely tenacious.
She's very tenacious and does not give up on anything, and
but
will impose her will on people. But she's never struck me as a very strong or fast fighter. That's not really what makes her game tick.
The technique is certainly not there to make up for what she lacks.
Yeah.
I don't think I watched last week's event before really going back and doing a deep dive on Blanchfield. And then I did watch a bunch of Blanchfield, and I think my opinion about a potential fight between her and Rose Namajunas changed. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm no longer confident she would out-wrestle Rose Namajunas.
Yeah.
She very well could get to her and make her super uncomfortable with the just insane pressure. Mm-hmm. She sort of fights in a Jessica Andrade way.
Yep.
But I'm not sure she would actually out-wrestle her, because she couldn't out-wrestle J.J. Aldrich.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying when it comes to strength, like raw horsepower.
I think it was just technique. I mean, she was able to get Aldrich into wrestling position. She just didn't know how to finish. She got her into a... single leg at one point and then just sort of ran at her. I think she maybe tried to like crack her down once, but Aldrich was just too quick on her feet and just slipped out. And yeah, she went for an inside trip against Aldrich. She just plowed through and Aldrich kept her whizzer, something Manon Fiore is very good at doing, by the way. She just kept her whizzer and just like hip heist did straight out of it. It didn't.
Yeah, I guess I'm just feeling like if it were Jessica Andrade doing that same kind of thing, she would get the takedown on JJ.
Yeah. That's fair enough. That's fair enough. But yeah, it's she fights. I see what you're saying with the Makhachev thing. She fights too much like she's incredibly strong because
yeah,
her actual technical wrestling just isn't that deep. And of course, against Tyler Santos, I mean, she connected on a ton of doubles.
Mm-hmm.
And all Santos had to do was just get driven back to the fence, get an overhook, yank the grip up, and then Blanchfield is still in a very good wrestling position, body lock, double unders, and she didn't really know how to get a takedown from there.
Yep.
She had it a lot. And she kept trying to do that awkward thing you see from people with jiu-jitsu backgrounds but no wrestling game where they just sort of like, I don't know, outside trip.
Mm-hmm.
She just sort of tries to step around Tyler Santos's leg and like she can get it as deep as she wants, but there's no angle change, no real leverage. And then Tyler just sort of pulls her leg out.
Yep.
So that right there really makes me lean Fiore for this matchup.
Mm-hmm.
Because Fiore is a very strong defensive wrestler.
She is.
And she appears to be a very strong scrambler as well, because on the few occasions she has been taken down, she really just keeps the momentum going and doesn't settle and pops right back up. She, like I said, she usually keeps that whizzer and just uses it to stand up. On the other hand, assuming that Blanchfield will do her usual thing and bring an insane amount of pressure and simply not care about getting hit, that does seem poised to make Fiore pretty uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a question of, like, here's the thing. I think Fiore could kind of get out of Dodge for free if she just sort of lets Blanchfield run her into the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And then just doesn't get taken down. Because, like, Blanchfield's, if you let her, she's going to follow through and crash into you.
Yep.
So if you just try to gallop and sidestep away, she might chase you and get a bunch of shots off that, like, you don't actually have to give her the room to land those shots.
Mm-hmm.
Because what she really wants to do is smash into you so she can try to wrestle you. And I think Fiore can probably stop that. So I could totally see this being a matchup that just gets worse and worse for Fiore, assuming Blanchfield's conditioning holds up. They both seem to be really well conditioned.
Yeah.
I can totally see this one sort of slipping out of Fiore's control, but I expect her to have a very strong start and to be more than strong enough and technical enough on the defense to just be really difficult for Blanchfield to actually take down.
Yeah, I mean, there's another thing here, too, for me, which is, like, Blanchfield, I would, you know, I'm not even still sure that Blanchfield beat Tyler Santos.
Yeah,
but I'm absolutely sure that she wouldn't have if Tyler Santos were a more comfortable, confident striker.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of that was just a lot of what let Blanchfield win is that Tyler Santos, she came out just like ready to burn and ready to try and, you know, get Blanchfield out of there as fast as she could. Essentially, she lit her up in the first round.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely lit her up. But that was also very much a Tyler Santos tactic to not have to try and not have to deal with the striking and the pressure for the rest of the fight.
Yeah.
You know, and the once it didn't work, she just let herself get trapped into a wall and stall game.
Yeah. I just looked it up. MMA decisions, every single person gave it 29-28 Blanchfield, which I get.
Yeah.
But having just watched it, I don't think it's a very convincing win.
No, it's really not.
Because Santos actually lands more strikes, I believe, in the second round. They're certainly cleaner and much harder.
Mm-hmm.
And then Blanchfield gets a ton of control time to eat up a lot of the clock, but doesn't do anything with it.
Yep.
So I don't think it would be crazy to say that Santos won that fight.
Yeah. And it's not even like, you know, it's not, I'm not saying, oh, the decision was wrong or bad or anything.
No, I get it either way, but it was not a convincing win from Blanchfield. Yeah. She didn't really solve the problems she was having in that fight.
It should be noted, too, that I was not working that night. So the MMA media scores present there are really not valid in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. But Fiore is not a fighter. Like, she can get gallopy, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. and she can get uncomfortable with the kind of striking fight that she's being forced to have, but she doesn't seem like a fighter who gets uncomfortable with having to continue striking regardless. No, you know,
she's very workmanlike.
Yeah. And she might make some bad positional decisions. She might get on her bike too much, whatever. But much like Edson Barboza, you know, the end result is still like, okay, even if I get gallopy and had to just like eat five shots while on my bike that I should have just sat down and defended and answered.
Mm-hmm.
The end goal for Edson Barboza is still always, I'm going to just circle far away where I can plant my feet again and feel confident that I can return to having a striking battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if Fiore can do that, then I have to pick her over Blanchfield, just because there's not enough that Blanchfield does effectively standing for me to just be confident that she will beat people that she can strike with her and that she can't take down.
Yeah, it's just the pace and the tenacity, it wears on people.
Yeah.
And again, full marks to Erin Blanchfield for being insane.
Yeah.
Because like, she doesn't have a normal human response to getting hit and getting punished. Like, she just eats it and keeps going. She's got that Billy Quarantillo thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she's not really technically good anywhere except on the ground.
Yep. And I just feel like whether it's Fiore or Grasso or Shevchenko, maybe eventually even Macy Barber, that those people are going to make Blanchfield pay for that. You know, they're just going to be able, they're just going to be strong enough to stay up. I could see her getting Grasso.
I could see her getting through Grasso's takedown defense, to be honest. But
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Anyone else who is either really good defensively with grappling and wrestling and or very strong.
Yeah.
Blanchfield will lose to them.
Yep.
And again, I think that now for me even possibly includes the not particularly inspiring looking flyweight Rose Namajunas.
Yeah,
like might be. Not actually a bad defensive wrestler, really. She can get taken down, but you know, you kind of have to be like decent at it.
Yep. Blanchfield's wrestling game is just not good. Blanchfield is the favorite, though, at the moment. Opened at -141, is currently at -176. Fiore opened at +127, currently up +157. So those odds are getting wider in Blanchfield's favor. I don't know. I don't love it. You know? I think that Blanchfield has worked herself into a game that at her current technical level of striking and wrestling, even though she's got like the meta game down, the whole aggression, volume, pressure, modern MMA thing, I just think that she's also so limited as a striker and wrestler that she has walked herself into a meta game that, or into a fight style that won't work at the top level.
Yeah.
And I think that Tyler Santos fight kind of displayed it. Like,
I mean, she probably has a lot more time and room to
develop her skills. Sure, she's only 24. Skills.
Yeah, Fjord, yeah. Fjord, she's 10 years younger than Fjord.
Yeah.
Fjord is, I mean, I'm pleased to see that at this age, she is, I think, still polishing her game.
Mm-hmm.
But she certainly looks like much more of a finished product than Blanchfield, and I think that's that may come through here.
Yeah. All right. That brings us to a welterweight bout, Vicente Luque, Joaquin Buckley. And I'm honestly feeling pretty conflicted about this one, too. Because
me too.
This is a fight that I would have very easily picked Vicente Luque to win 4 years ago. In around the Randy Brown, Nico Price era of Vicente Luque. But it has to be noted, going all the way back to Brian Barberena in 2019, Vicente Luque loves to punch with a puncher. And he will, his grappling actually tends to mostly show up against people that don't want to strike with him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to grapple with Vicente Luque, he will grapple with you and potentially beat you there. But if you want to go out and just throw hands with Vicente Luque, like I say, he will have a stand-up battle with Brian Barberena. You know? Toe-to-toe. Wrestling non-master. And that, or, you know, he'll have three rounds with Jeff Neal where he's just forced to trade hands and just constantly in that fight. And Joaquin Buckley, like, you know, I don't know that the RDA fight really showed me how much damage Luque can take still.
Yeah.
It was a good performance of him from him, but it was mostly just kind of a throw a couple strikes, weave your way into the clinch, and it turns out that RDA really just still is not a welterweight. And for somehow being very powerful as a lightweight, can get hossed around a little up a division. And that's not likely to be Joaquin Buckley. I mean, Buckley can be taken down. So if Luque wants to work that, that might be there for him. But if Luque wants to just do his pressure counter thing, then Buckley's going to be there to meet him over and over and over again for every minute of this fight. And they will probably just kind of have a bunch of puncher exchanges where you're really taking a chance on whether Luque can go can slip and return fire, or whether he's going to take the shots and return fire, and then you're just betting on whose chin is better right now. Which, you know, it's tough because I've seen Buckley get knocked out too.
Sure.
And he has this very set, like, bouncy rhythm. He only enters in online. You can always tell where when Joaquin Buckley is driving into the pocket. And that's why he gets knocked out, is just because people can find him right on the forward step and meet him with a shot.
Yeah.
So
not a big fainter, Joaquin Buckley.
No, I mean, he will mix up his attacks really well.
Yeah.
So that you have to guess what's coming when he steps in. That's,
yeah, but it's like the old Jackson Wink thing. Like,
yeah,
all of Joaquin Buckley's switch ups depend on you feeling like you're in a position where you just sort of have to guess what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And like, it's not actually doing all the work to maintain the initiative that kind of trap requires.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, if you have a switch up that like, oh, this, you might get hit by three different things, but I can effectively just nail you with a jab down the middle.
Yeah.
In response to all of them, then that's not really a good switch up, is it?
That is the eternal walking Buckley problem.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to pick him here. I'm going to go out on a limb and just take him anyway. Cause
I'm feeling Buckley too.
It is a fight that I know Luque at one point could have managed really well. But like I say, you go Nico Price, Mike Perry, Randy Brown, Brian Barberena. When somebody has wanted to just go out and swing hands with Vicente Luque, yeah. Jeff Neal, even Bilal Muhammad,
mm-hmm.
like Vicente Luque will have a really hard fight just trading shots with all of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Because he does not refuse exchanges. And he wants you to throw first. He wants an opponent that meets him with his pressure with strikes. That is how Luque's striking game has always worked. And I think he's a little less fast now and a little less durable now.
Mm-hmm.
And Buckley is predictable and he can be caught. But he is still really fast and hits really hard and seems like kind of a tank at 170 right now. So I'm going to go with Luque fighting down to the level of his competition and losing here.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't feel confident about it.
No.
But I sort of arrived at the same conclusion. I mean, it's tough for me because I've had some real evaluation whiplash with Vicente Luque because I was so down on him before the RDA fight because of all the terrible things I'd heard about his health problems and how increasingly unconfident and fragile he had been looking in his previous fights. And then he went in there against RDA and he looked fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I just went back and rewatched it, of course, for this. And I was like, it's not really a good performance, is it?
No.
It's not actually very good. It seems more to fit into the category of fights that welterweight RDA has and fights that old RDA has.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as we talked about with Mateusz Gamrot, RDA, he's a remarkable, whether a product of chemical engineering or natural biology. The man is ageless in a certain respect, but not really ageless.
Yeah.
He's not pulling the trigger as much. He doesn't have that dogged determination to stick to a game plan. Something which he never really had at welterweight because he doesn't really feel like he can bully people. That's at least my theory. And this was another welterweight fight. And an old RDA fight in which he didn't really do much to pressure Luque.
Mm-hmm.
And yet neither did Luque pressure welterweight RDA. The thing that makes RDA actually implode, he couldn't actually do it. And it's not that he didn't try. My memory of the fight was that he just wanted to do capital T technical. He wanted to jab RDA and stop his takedowns, whatever. In review, there are actually several attempts in the fight from Luque to try to get some pressure going. And what happens is he runs into something and changes his mind.
Mm-hmm.
That did not used to happen. So, yeah, it wasn't a much better showing than I expected in my doom and gloom hour. Yes. Was it a performance that looks like Vicente Luque has recaptured what used to make him great? Not for me.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the same questions are just there. And I think a more sort of reticent, hesitant, fragile Vicente Luque if you're saying that, okay, he might not even try to pressure Buckley, and then you're saying he's going to win this because he's going to catch Buckley on the way in with a counter, that's certainly possible. Luque can counterpunch. But it really feels like a pretty shaky path to victory. To just sort of let Buckley have the driver's seat and knock him out. Again, could happen. And as you said, and you did not overstate the fact, like, Buckley is not a smooth pressure striker.
No.
He doesn't have a whole lot of sense for what's actually happening in the exchanges. He sort of makes a read, loads up, and goes for it. And when he throws a combination, he knew what the combination was going to be, you know, four punches ago by the end of it. He didn't, at no point did he change course, did he adjust to the realities of the position. He is not an organic striker. Very mechanical.
Yeah. He's Carlos Condit without the, like, the filler, you know?
Yeah, I'm not even
with
sure.
With more power.
But I'm not even sure that he really has Condit's deftness for, like, changing up his attacks. And, you know, Condit was a very, very adaptable striker.
He was. Buckley changed. I mean, I think he does the same kind of flow chart thing is what I'm saying. Is it like,
yeah,
he does just like kind of, he's working through a whole bunch of stuff he knows.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do it in the volume, or he doesn't do it with like the combinations that Condit would do. And he doesn't have the toughness, because a lot of what sold Condit to
for sure
doing that kind of thing was just how unhumanly durable he was.
Yeah. But for Buckley, he's also not as big as Condon.
Yeah.
But for Buckley, it really suffers by the fact that he's like trying to throw everything with like full loaded up muscle power.
It's not a deft sort of like, here's a tricky combination, and then here's my next tricky combination. It's like, here's my wheel kick. Okay, here's my overhand. Okay, here's my uppercut to hook. Okay, here's me going to the body. Okay, here's, you know, and he just kind of.
Condit was much smoother and savvier. Awkward as he was.
Yeah.
He was a much more flexible guy, like mid exchange.
Yeah.
You know, Buckley looks strong and fast and in great condition, even at welterweight. He hits hard, and I have a feeling that Luque might just sort of let him walk him down, and it feels like a gamble you don't want to take as an old version of Vicente Luque.
Yeah, that's my feeling too. So, I'll be happy if I'm wrong and Luque just like takes him down and taps him out.
Sure, or starches him with a left hook.
Starches him with a counter hook. Could all happen, but
for sure.
He
could also, like, this is the thing. Luque does genuinely have so much more sort of feel for striking. Like, it's not impossible that he sort of just jabs Joaquin Buckley.
Sure.
And just by virtue of not being as flimsy as Alex Morono, who really did enjoy plenty of success with his approach. He just, you know, he's made of twigs and chewing gum.
Yeah.
That maybe that just works. If Luque can just stick to a capital T technical game plan, because Buckley's just doesn't scream smart fighter.
I just get the feeling that this is going to be that 2019 fight with Mike Perry, only it's 5 years later and Luque is not that guy anymore.
Yeah.
That's what that was a fight that he barely won, scraped by on the skin of his teeth. Against Mike Perry, just a hammer and tong. Do you remember, like, his face was just like their noses were both just like mashed to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just get the feeling this will be that fight, but against, you know, but 5 years on.
Yeah.
So I'm picking Buckley. It is wild though that Luque is still only 32.
Yeah, I mean, he has been through it though.
Yeah, I mean he's another great case in point of why I of why I don't like to see fighters go get pro as young, that young. Because, like, you're 32 and it feels like you're an old man because... I mean,
you know, whatever, you had a whole career.
Yeah, no, it's fine, but a lot of times for a lot of fighters, the actual money-making years of their career...
Yeah,
right. Are like 32 to 40, or, you know, they're like 35 to 40. Or...
Yeah, but that's not because people like 32-year-olds. It's because it takes till that point for anybody to know who the hell they are.
Yeah.
You know, he had a whole career. He had a whole phase in the middle in the early UFC career where he was just really just getting a lot better. And shoring up a lot of his early weaknesses. He just started that process sooner.
Yep. So, yeah, taking Buckley. Yeah, he has. Luque has been at it for 15 years. So. Mm-hmm.
I do hope Luque beats him though.
Yeah, well, I do too. I'd love to see it from Luque. You know, he's got, like I say, you bring this back to his Randy Brown, Nico Price 2 fights a few years ago, and I'm picking Vicente Luque here. Like,
yeah,
he will just meet Joaquin Buckley, and he's a slicker counterpuncher. He will meet those exchanges that Buckley wants to have. And be ready to throw back. And we have seen plenty of fights where Buckley just runs into something and goes out.
Mm-hmm.
It is not, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility for him ever. So could happen, but. All right. Odds for that fight. Buckley is. It's basically dead even. Buckley opened at plus 127. He's currently at plus 104. Luque opened at minus 141. He's currently at minus 114. They were, even just a moment ago, at like both at minus 105. So action on that is right in the middle.
Feels reasonable to me.
Yeah. All right. That brings us to a middleweight bout. Chris Weidman, Bruno Silva, and... a very winnable fight for Chris Weidman still, but I would be goddamned if I'm going to pick him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's winnable. I guess I don't know what's winnable for Chris Weidman anymore. Like, the man barely scraped past Omari Akhmedov. That was his last win. That was now 4 years ago. 4 years, a long time when you're 39 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up hot on 40, in fact.
And let's be clear, too. It was not a great win.
No, that's what I mean. He barely scraped by a purely mid-tier middleweight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess what you're saying is that, like, Bruno Silva does suck.
Yeah, he can be taken down. He can be out-wrestled. He is almost entirely boxing-centric. And
would you call it boxing?
Punching-centric. Punching.
That's more like it. He's entirely
punching-centric and heavy in his stance.
He can be taken down, out-box. He can be everything.
Yeah.
He is a true brawler.
Yeah.
Including the fact that, like a lot of brawlers, it seems to be he's just running on panic fumes the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's not sure what's happening. He doesn't like it. He's swatting at bees. He is an absolute mess of a fighter.
There's like, a reason that Gerald Meerschaert tuned him up standing.
Yeah, exactly. But if you want to do a little casual MMA math, he nuked Brad Tavares, who just soundly beat Chris Weidman.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Weidman is, go back a few years to when he got knocked out by Luke Rockhold, Yoel Romero, and Gegard Mousasi. Mm-hmm. And he was breakable, but it was really like you had to go through hell to break him.
Yeah, it still took some doing.
It was a, he was still rugged, and it was just that, like, the thing that he led, the way he led his striking, the path he led his striking down over the years, walked him into a trap that, as his speed and joint fluid started to go, he could not walk himself out of. Where
a man who waited way too long to become capital T technical.
Yeah,
it can work. Next week we've got Alexander Hernandez fighting.
Yeah,
and that's a guy for whom I think the process is finally yielding some real results in like slickness and feel and comfort under pressure. I think his last fight, even though he lost, was one of his most mature performances ever. But he decided to be capital T technical really early in his career because he realized he wasn't ready for the level he reached and had to make some drastic overcorrections to adjust. Chris Weidman was a champion before he decided to be capital T technical.
Yeah.
He was already like 32.
Yep. And so, yeah, you know, he built this very aggressive, very face forward boxing style, high output.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kept him in the teeth of danger.
Mm-hmm.
But he was still that dude. He was still very much an elite good fighter in that run of losses. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, he was just trapped by stylistic problems.
Yeah, yeah. He had a very even fight with Rockhold. He was hitting takedowns on Yoel Romero.
Yep.
For sure.
And the Dominic Reyes fight was a real changing moment.
Mm-hmm.
And what changed there, and it showed up in that Brad Tavares fight again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the Akhmadov fight, too. I didn't go back and watch that one, but my recollection is of it is such. These days, the first time Chris Weidman gets hit hard in a fight, he gets shook up.
Yeah, he doesn't want to do it anymore.
Well, he just
this is what I mean before when you said he still enjoys the training. And I was like, you don't have to fight because he doesn't seem to like it.
Yeah, he just, I think it's not, I don't even know if it's that he doesn't like it. It's just that he gets hurt.
Yeah, but then he's immediately in survival mode for as long as he has left in the fight. He got hurt once by Brad Tavares. And then he was just like clinging on for dear life. Like, it can't be a fun experience. He doesn't
look confident. Yeah, I'm sure he doesn't like it. I'm just saying, like, you know, it used to be that he wasn't getting hurt when he got hit. And so he didn't have to be panicked. But now every time he gets hit clean, it shakes him. And Bruno Silva, for all his ills, knows how to hit people clean.
And very hard.
And unfortunately for White, one of the things he was talking about with his injury this week is how he lost a lot of muscle in his leg from that injury. And one of the things that came up, I mean, I know that Brad Tavares is a hard guy to take down. It's no shame in not taking him down.
No, certainly, yeah.
But it can't help but look like Chris Weidman. He already had knee and like back injuries, I think, anyway. And his knees were gone from all his wrestling years anyway. But he doesn't really have the leg drive to be a power takedown artist anymore.
Yeah. He really should be able to take Bruno Silva down.
He should. But the thing is that if he doesn't have the leg drive, he has to set up the takedown.
Yeah.
If he can't just go in there and scoop his opponent off their feet, then he has to punch his way into position where he can get a takedown and surprise his opponent.
He doesn't really seem to have his clinch takedown game anymore either. He used to have some dope clinch takedowns.
Yeah.
When he was a young MMA fighter, he was like lat dropping people. He was doing all kinds of crazy shit. And he doesn't really seem to have that as a fallback either.
So if he doesn't have an easy access to takedowns, then that means he, even if he has to just spend a minute punching with Bruno Silva,
Yeah.
You have to be very worried. So, yeah, I got to take Bruno
Silva. And even if he gets Bruno Silva down, you better finish him.
Yep.
Because then the next round's going to come and probably some piece will have fallen off of Chris Weidman's body.
Yep.
And it's just like things just go downhill so fast for Chris Weidman in these last several years.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Bruno Silva is a favorite, opened at minus 278, is currently minus 275. Weidman is the underdog, opened at plus 215, is still at plus 215. All right. That brings us to Nursultan Ruziboyev against Cedriquis Dumas. And I'm picking Nursultan Ruziboyev because Dumas is still trying to learn how to fight.
Yeah. What did he get in trouble for, by the way? Didn't he do something that the UFC swept under the rug?
Yeah, he showed up at an ex-girlfriend's house and tried to...
Oh, that's...
He got in a fight and then went on a walk to cool off. And the cops pulled him over and he tried to talk his way out of getting arrested and then got arrested.
Oh, who did he fight? His girlfriend or like her ex, her new boyfriend?
I think his girlfriend.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if he actually hit her or just violated a restraining order or something or just threatened her.
I mean, dog, if you got a restraining order to begin with. Yeah, it's not a good look. We'll leave it at that. I don't know the details, obviously. So
he's got like 12, 13 arrests in his life. He's got enough that, you know. The man.
I mean, you know, let's be fair. If I don't know what those arrests are for, a great many of them could be for being a black guy. So yeah. I don't know. But
at least a couple of them are for domestic violence.
Related. Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah.
No excuse for that one. Anyway, yeah, he does suck at fighting too. So that's good.
He's huge and he's athletic, but he's clearly just. He started out in a gym that could not teach him anything except a little bit of grappling and being huge and athletic. That was enough to carry him through a lot of fights against mostly bad opposition. But you watch those fights and you see a guy who like can throw one horribly ugly strike at a time before falling into the clinch, would often like pull guard or end up on bottom and would just sort of be able to grime his way into top control. And then you have, you know, two fights with two glass, three fights, one with Josh Fremd, who's as big or bigger and just beat him. And then the others with two glass cannons who just cannot stop themselves from making horrendous mistakes where Dumas was able to ride out fights. And I still feel like Nursultan Ruziboyev might be a bit of a can crusher.
Oh, yeah.
Most of his opposition throughout his career is bad, and any of his opposition that was good has beat him.
Mm-hmm.
But he is also really practiced.
Yeah.
He has taken a lot of fights. He's been in a lot of fights. And
it's a benefit of can crushing.
Yeah. And he knows how to handle himself and what he wants to do. And that showed pretty quickly in that Bruno Ferreira fight where Ferreira made one dumb mistake and Ruziboyev just pounced on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he can do that against Dumas as well.
Yeah, probably. Dumas is going to give him range where Ruziboyev is, you know, a somewhat dangerous kicker. He's going to try to awkwardly march forward and Ruziboyev can hit some reactive takedowns. I mean, literally the takedown he hit on Fajeda, where he just sort of accidentally knocked him out, catching the leg and firing the right hand. That's like his move.
Yep.
He loves to do that, like knee tap right hand takedown. Yeah, he's totally a can crusher, but he has a game.
Yep.
And it's pretty decent. It makes sense. And he doesn't really stray from it. Like, he doesn't make a lot of crazy, stupid decisions or anything. So it just kind of feels like unless Dumas can just get into horrible positions and just power his way out of them, like maybe it turns out he's just a lot stronger than Ruzibayev.
That would be the kind of thing that Ruzibayev can lose to. He's not really a great athlete, and he's not flexible really at all either.
Yep.
So once he starts losing, he kind of tends to just lose.
Yeah. So if that happens, that's a way for it to fall apart. But it does just Dumas's game is just absolutely full of holes. It's more hole than substance, really.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I feel like he beat Cody Brundage is that Brundage would just jump for a guillotine every time on this much bigger man and end up on bottom for the whole fight because of it.
Yep.
And Abu Azaitar is literally just has no confidence at all. Like, he's just out there to, if I can knock you out immediately, great. And if I can't, then I don't know what I'm doing, really.
Yeah.
So. Ruzibayev is a big favorite here. Opened at minus 299, is currently minus 237. Dumas opened at plus 253, is currently at plus 207. So, yeah, those odds should be, they should be closer. These are two can crushers fighting each other. And you're really just going to see which one of them, like, this won't even tell us anything, because it'll just, one of them is going to be more a can than the other.
Yep.
As a can crusher. And we will find out at the time on the night, which one that is, I guess.
Yep. Don't really fully get why Cedriguis Dumas is here.
Yeah,
I don't really see whatever, but he came off the Contender Series, right?
Yep.
All right, well.
But it's just more sign that they sign anybody who gets a win anymore.
Yeah, I'm not really seeing that potential. You sign a guy like Peyton Talbot, I'm with you.
Yep.
I get it.
But a guy who just can't really fight?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm understanding his presence.
Yeah. All right. That brings us to an awesome fight. Bill Algeo, Kyle Nelson.
Yeah.
And man, this is a fight that any other time before the past 2 years, I would pick Bill Algeo very confidently. But right now, I don't know. What are you thinking?
I mean, my gut says I feel bad for Kyle Nelson.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it's destined to happen if you suddenly sort of turn things around and realize you have this really efficient, simple, methodical game that you can play. And that leads to you beating people, including an up and comer with potential like Fernando Padilla. You're going to end up fighting good people.
Yeah.
So, you know, what can you do? That's the business. But it has just been like, it's been working convincingly, but not like super impressively.
Yeah, I mean, like, it is very much, he's taking a lot of shots in these fights still. He's neutralizing, but not neutralizing so efficiently that he's just running away with a fight.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the secret to Kyle Nelson's recent success has been that he's finally discovered, like, he doesn't have to do stuff all the time.
Yeah.
He has really two very reliable tools, which are the low kick and the jab.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the right idea of how to use his feet to keep that jab online and not get cornered. But the real secret is just that, like, he just doesn't. He's finally learned to control himself.
Yeah.
And to be satisfied with those weapons working and to find little ways of continuing to make them work. But like, Bill Algeo is super tough and he can probably find a lot of ways of making the fight keep happening. And
to say, the thing with Algeo really is that whether you're pushing him back or he's pushing you back, he is always initiating a pocket exchange that he could come out on top of.
Yeah.
And we've seen even against like a huge puncher like Joe Anderson Brito, he can ride that train to a win.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, he is. It's not as easy as it seems to hit him really clean.
Yeah.
But he's also just insanely tough.
Yeah.
And he's. I feel like. And it's funny because he lost to him. I feel like Bill Aljo is a good heir to the Andre Feely gatekeeper throne.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot in his game where I'm like, why did you do that goofy thing?
Yeah, I mean,
Aljo is continuing to win the fight.
Aljo is a lot like Fernando Padilla in that he is a tall fly or featherweight who does not really fight long or fight tall.
Yeah.
This can also be a Julian Arosa problem where it's like you're not going in and like being this great step knee clinch elbow you know hard, like wear on somebody inside tall man and you're not really having a long graceful sniper stance to pick somebody off from range. Instead, you're really just kind of waiting for somebody to step in on you or trying to create a pocket where you can scrap and throw down. And if you can do that, you're going to win. And if you can't, you're very beatable because you don't have a game that really stretches in any other directions. You know?
Yeah, I mean, like... He was sort of fighting long against Alex Hernandez.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there were definitely stretches of that fight where he was, like, popping out a southpaw jab. I was like, hey, you know how to do that.
Yeah.
That's cool. And then he would just periodically just, like, bomb in with an overhand right for no particular reason.
Yeah.
He's just not a consistent fighter.
No.
But he is consistently tough and scrappy. And he can access these little moments of really impressive fluid combination striking.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they seem to come out of nowhere. But if Bill Aljo gets one little reaction out of you, he gets like one little slice of initiative where he touches you and you take a halting step back. He can string together some really creative, effective combinations. You know, he's like touches Hernandez with a jab or a front kick at one point. And then Hernandez takes a step back and he like switches stance and feints and throws a hook, which Hernandez ducks into a knee.
Yeah.
That hits Hernandez right in the chin. Like that's a really slick, flowing combination. He's just weird. But I am going to take him because I feel like one thing is for sure. If Bill Aljo feels he needs to put his foot on the gas and push the pace to win, like I fully think Kyle Nelson could enjoy a good round or more.
Oh yeah, no question.
Just because he's just so consistent, and Aljo just keeps his hands down by his nipples, and he's just going to eat a bunch of jabs from the shockingly long ape-like arms of Kyle Nelson, and he's going to eat low kicks. And he's going to struggle to cut off the cage because he doesn't really have a coordinated way of doing that. But if he just needs to just pile shit on and get really aggressive to regain some momentum, that he will reach a point in basically every fight where he does that.
Yeah, I mean, the fights that Nelson had with Padilla and Bilder were both like really solid wins for Nelson compared to the losses he used to have. But they were not really solid wins all on their own merit.
Yeah.
They are fights where Nelson is really scraping by.
Yeah,
and it's impressive that a guy who, you know, once got arm triangled by Matt Sales, of all people.
Yeah, he used to implode. That's why it's so impressive. Implode,
and now he's scraping by, and that's impressive. But Bilder and Padilla both got a lot of shots in on Nelson and did a lot of work, and they just couldn't maintain. And Padilla, like I said, Padilla and Aljo, they have some similarities, but Aljo is much more of a determined creator than Padilla.
Yeah.
And he gets only more fearless the longer the fight goes. And that is, I think, the biggest thing that's going to hurt Nelson here is that Nelson himself is not a fast starter in his in these fights. He has been trying to be reserved and often losing first rounds because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the later rounds where his newfound calm is helping keep him in the bout. And Algio is a dude who not only will he start fast, but every round beyond that, every minute beyond that, he will use to try to ramp up the pressure.
Yeah.
So I gotta take Algio.
He's here. A bit like Randy Brown, Bill Algio, in his approach. Mm-hmm. But like, what if Randy Brown had a granite chin and knew it?
Yeah.
You know, it sort of changes everything.
Yeah.
He can make a lot of those insane innovator decisions a lot more fearlessly, and it makes more sense. Yeah. It's, yeah. I feel bad for Kyle Nelson because I have so loved his turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
But he feels like he's fought himself up to a level where just sticking to the basics, it just doesn't always work against a guy who I've said this a lot recently, but it's always a useful thing to keep in mind. Like, there are rules of how striking is supposed to work. There's a proper way of doing things, and they're proper for a reason. Because, like, controlling somebody from distance and fighting to keep good angles, like, you know, like a normal person you're fighting has to, like, respect those things and respond to them. And you establish these threats, right? You sting them, and then they get more respect. And then there's guys like Bill Algio who just don't respect it.
Yeah.
And so, like, suddenly you sort of, your reliance on the way things are supposed to work can lead to you getting a very rude shock by somebody who just crashes through anyway.
Yep.
And that makes Bill Algio sound a lot cruder than he is. Like I said, he is capable of being really slick and creative.
Yeah.
He's just disorganized.
Mm-hmm. Odds on the fight. It is, like I say, it is a fight like 2 or 3 years ago, I would have been absolutely certain Algio wins this no matter what. Right now, this is, you know, this will at least be interesting.
Yeah, it'll be competitive, Nelson, for at least a bit.
If Nelson can neutralize Algio at all and just stick with that, like I say, yeah. Algio's game is not, like, there's not that wide a berth of places where Algio can stay successful.
Mm-hmm.
He really does tend to have to force you to get into, you know, there's a bit of Aaron Blanchfield there of just like reinitiating the car crash all the time.
Yeah.
Algio opened at -190, is currently a -233. Nelson opened at +169, is currently a +203. All right. Final fight of the main card, Chidi Njikwani, Reese McKee. And Chidi Njikwani, because Reese McKee is not a good enough athlete to survive.
Yeah, it seems like they just thought, we have two tall, skinny guys. Let's have them fight.
Well, and Njikwani is dropping down a division back to welterweight after his three straight middleweight losses. And so I'm sure that's just sort of like, okay, well, let's see what you can do down in this division. When was the last time he even fought at welterweight? Andre Korshkov and Melvin Gillard were like, and Andre Fialho were all catchweight bouts back in Bellator. He last hit the actual welterweight limit against Thiago Gonçalves in 2016. So,
well, maybe he'll look rough. I mean, that's a good hope for Reese McKee.
Yeah, but the truth for Reese McKee just ends up being always he's really tough, and he has a style that is built on pace and pressure and just sort of becoming a momentum stealer. That does not work when you are just way weaker than your opposition. You see him out on the regionals where he can fight a lot of other mediocre athletes. Reese McKee wins all the time. Yep. He is quadruple A star. But then, like, and against Anja Lusa, when Lusa started to gas late in that fight, then you suddenly see, oh, here's what Rhys McKee can do.
Yeah, he was still there, had the toughness, and
yep. He would just start pouring it on. He is, you know, he's really hard to finish, and he has a ton of heart. But the first round of that Anja Lusa fight, Anja Lusa beat his ass. Just pillar to post. The speed and power difference on display. I mean, Alex Morono was just too much for Rhys McKee. Yep. He is not a powerful, strong, dynamic man. So Gidi Njikwani's wait, see, and counter game is full of problems. But I gotta pick him.
Yep. That's what I got.
Yeah.
Said it all.
And Jaquani opened at -214. He's currently at -141. McKee opened at +188. Currently at +127. I don't really know why it's getting closer. Look, I get Njikwani's coming off three losses and whatever, but like we saw him against Dusko Todorovic, smoked him.
Yep.
Knocked out Marc-Andre Barrio. Had a really tough fight with Albert Duraev. The fact that Gregory Rodriguez and Mikhail Oleksija cleaned his clock. Like, nothing about either of those men reflects Rhys McKee. You know?
Maybe Oleksija a little bit. I don't know. I suppose, again, maybe people are taking a chance on the possibility of him not looking good in his first visit to 170.
Yeah, could be. In years.
What was it? 8 years. Yeah. He's not a small man.
No.
So there's a very realistic possibility that he looks really fragile or his reaction times look really slow and maybe Rhys McKee could actually overwhelm him a bit. But assuming he looks anything like the guy he has been at middleweight, it's hard to pick Rhys McKee.
Yeah. All right, on that note, we're going to wrap things up. Stick around for a little bonus content if you're a subscriber to our Substack. And if you are not, then sign up, subscribe. We will see you in just a moment.
To access the bonus content of this episode, you must be a paid subscriber. To do that, go to themmadrawpodcast.substack.com and subscribe today.